Coming up on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we're talking open access publishing with Peter Binfield and Jason Hoyt from PeerJ. That's up next on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki, episode 149, recorded Thursday, June 28th, 2012. Tear down that wall! Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. This is the show where I talk with one expert for 1 hour. One topic, one expert, one... I'm doing something wrong here because, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Once again, bucking tradition. This time I've got two experts, and they're experts in a fascinating field, a field that is undergoing massive disruption at their hands. and it, you know... doesn't matter what my normal rules are, because this is a very special hour. This is the very last hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. So, yes, that's right. You heard me say it. The Science Hour has been canceled, unfortunately. So I apologize and say that you won't be getting any more Science Hours from here on out. So just listen up, right? Listen up right now and savor this time that we have
free flow
together.
Of information. It's all about.
The end of an era.
The end of an era, exactly. You might notice some music coming in the background. This was a little mashup that was put together by someone on YouTube a couple of years ago after I had these two guests that I have on the show today on the show before. They've been on the show before, 2 years ago. So I really, really hope that you're ready to dig in and get dirty with this topic. We're going to be talking about science and open access and publishing and disrupting the landscape of scientific publishing with my special guests, Dr. Peter Binfield and Jason Hoyt. And they are both part of a new company just launched this month called PeerJ. And it's a new player in the science publishing landscape. Welcome, both you guys. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invite.
You're welcome. So before I give the big bio reads on both of you, I just wanted to go back in the little Dr. Kiki Science Hour time capsule, because there is a clip available on YouTube of the last time that I had you guys on the show. So
when we were younger and...
Exactly.
And had no hair.
I think you had no children, Jason. Peter had only one child.
Maybe one and a half by that point.
One and a half at that point. Exactly. And so this is a video clip. Take a look at our conversation. Leo Laporte was a part of it at that point in time. This is our conversation way back in 2009.
So it's been evolved for hundreds of years, and you can tweak the method and play with it, and we do that. But at the end of the day, you're still publishing a scientific paper, and it's still real scientists publishing it. It's still cited by other papers. It still counts towards their career track and so on.
So you're just going the same way that other print media is going. You're going online, basically.
We've gone online. For 10, 15 years now.
Has it been that long?
Journals have been online. What is happening now, I think the next step is actually is... going fully online. I mean, there's been a long period of being hybrid, so being both print and online.
Right.
And now what we're seeing, I think, is journals coming out as online-only journals, and that's what our journals are in PLOS. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that step, the ability to go online-only, the fact that people are no longer wedded to the paper version, a dead tree sitting on a shelf somewhere, that's really enabling some of the new business models, for instance, the open access business model that we advocate. So... I think it's that step, going online only, that is really turning the switch.
There's an inherent scarcity.
So 2-3 years ago, there was a lot starting to happen in the open access space. 3 years ago, Pete, you were at PLOS One. According to your bio, currently you're co-founder and publisher at Pier J. You're a physicist, gigapixel photographer. That sounds fascinating. You've worked in the academic publishing world for almost 20 years. And since gaining a PhD in optical physics, held positions at the Institute of Physics, Kluver Academic, Springer, SAGE, and PLOS, Public Library of Science, where you ran PLOS One. You developed it into the largest and most innovative journal in the world, and you are a respected authority in academic publishing and open access.
I wrote that bit myself.
It's good to say nice things about yourself. I am good at this, exactly. And Jason, now the co-founder and CEO, once a geneticist, always a geneticist, and always an indie rock daydreamer, now father to a toddler, little baby.
Father twice. I have two boys, yeah.
Yeah. Holding a PhD in genetics from Stanford University, where you worked under Michelle Kalos, researching human gene therapy. Before founding Pier J, you worked at Mendeley as chief scientist and vice president of R&D and pioneered the data mining group that scaled Mendeley's growth to crowdsource more than 150 million academic documents in just over 2 years, which is astounding. Under your direction, services such as personal recommendations, search, real-time statistics, and the Mendeley API were developed. And you strongly believe that research needs to be openly available if we're going to solve this century's biggest challenges. So, for the two of you, what happened since our interview 3 years ago when you were, Pete, working at PLOS, Jason, working at Mendeley, to get you to this point right now where you have started a massively disruptive company? Who wants to go for that one?
Jason, you want to take that?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, it goes back further than that, dating back to the grad school days and feeling the frustrations even then when I couldn't get access, even at Stanford, to information about some articles. Stanford is as rich as it is, along with Harvard, doesn't have access to everything. And of course, now, you know, Harvard's come out saying, hey, faculty, please don't publish behind paywalls, publish open access if you can, because we can't keep affording these subscription fees. So I've been feeling this for several years. Sometime last year, I felt like the frustration had just built up enough, the waiting game, waiting for either government or other publishers to take the lead and try to do something different just was not happening.
Wasn't happening at all.
No.
No. But so, Jason, you guys actually had not met prior to the interview that we had on the show. Is that correct?
We had met one time.
And what happened? Did you, after having the conversation that we had on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, Peter, maybe you can jump in on this, after the conversation that we had, like, where did you and Jason start talking, and how did that conversation go forward?
Pretty much parted ways at that point, actually. Really, we had a discussion at one point about possibly starting something else way back in the day, a different company. Mm-hmm. But then Jason got relocated back by Mendeley back to London. So he moved from San Francisco to London, and then we kept sort of professional contact over long distance, but didn't really interact very much from that point onwards. We definitely had some professional interactions. PLOS ran a binary battle competition with Mendeley for an API API app development competition. So we had some interactions there, but then not much until Jason got in touch with me in whenever it was, January of this year, saying he had a company and was I interested. And,
oh, very cool.
Yeah.
And so Jason, the company idea, you've been really thinking about this for ages, and finally the pieces started to come together.
Yeah. Well, Pete says I had a company. That's not true. It wasn't a company till Pete came on board and actually started making sense of the pieces that I was thinking of. And so, you know, this is definitely all Pete, basically, as well.
I can't hear anything.
We've muted his earphones. All right.
Yeah.
So certainly, you know, because of Pete's credibility with PLOS One, you know, I knew that we needed someone like Pete's caliber on board. because credibility is a huge thing when you're talking about starting up a new academic journal or publication.
Yeah, you don't think that you had enough credibility just coming from Mendeley and having worked on, you know, worked with this, with the data of academic publishing, mm-hmm. understanding the open access side of it. What did Pete bring that was that's
what's so special about
that special spark?
Well, certainly, you know, I'm very familiar from some angles of the publishing world. Pete is familiar in a lot of the other sides of publishing, and that's what was missing from my side. Maybe I bring some credibility from the tech side of things, which will help in recruiting engineers to work on this exciting problem. But certainly Pete is the name to really be attracting the type of academic editors that we need on board as well.
Yeah, I love the fact also you've got Tim O'Reilly on your board, mm-hmm. and that you're backed by O'Reilly Media, and this is really big because they are a huge player in disruptive media, in getting in promoting open publishing all over the place. How does having them on board, or having Tim O'Reilly on board, make add to things?
Right. Well, jump in, Pete. But Tim was actually the first. His investment company was the first and really the only investors that we wanted to have on board. They were the first ones we approached because we knew that with Tim's background in open sourcing, he's been involved at the congressional level with trying to push open access, speaking to Congress members. We knew that he would be a credible name to have backing us. We knew that academics might be skeptical of an investment group that didn't have open access in their best interests.
But like Elsevier.
We decided to stay away from Elsevier investing in this.
Yeah.
That's a really good point, though. You know, we could have taken VC funding from anyone with you know, no understanding of our business, no affinity for what we were trying to do, and we really wanted to avoid that. We wanted people who understood what we were doing, really got it, got the open side of it, the open access, open source side. And I mean, Tim O'Reilly is just obviously a fantastic fit from that point of view, and he understands publishing, of course, which is brilliant.
Yeah, you know, he's a major player in the publishing industry.
Yeah, we were really pleased to get that.
And so let's talk about PeerJ and what specifically PeerJ does. We've made references to it being disruptive. We've made references to open access. But how is PeerJ different from other science publishers?
So, initially it's an open access publication. So it's a scholarly journal publisher that publishes peer-reviewed scientific articles, and it publishes them under a Creative Commons license. So that means it's open access. Anyone is free to read it, download the content, reuse it, remix it, data mine it, and so on, mm-hmm. Without paying any fee, provided they credit the original source. So that's a really important distinction between an open access publisher and a subscription publisher. A subscription publisher would sell a subscription to the content. They actually own the content, and they don't let anyone to do anything interesting with it.
Yeah, so like myself currently, if I, not being affiliated with a university or a university library, or I have to pay a fee.
Exactly.
As a journalist to either get...
If you even can.
If
yes.
I even can get
you can
access
get
to a single article, right.
And single articles often, you know, they'll sell
30,
online
40, 50.
$30 to $50, $70 in some places. Just incredible for 24 hours access sometimes, which is just absolutely insane. So.
Yeah.
So that's a real fundamental difference, but that's nothing new that PeerJ is doing. There's many other open access publishers out there.
Right,
Plus,
you came from Plus,
where I just came from, for instance. So I think the next interesting thing that we're doing actually is our business model. So the typical business model for an open access publisher is that an author will pay a fee to publish. So in the case of Plus One, that fee is $1,350, for instance. And the typical range for the fee is about $1,000 up to as much as $5,000 that authors will pay an open access publisher for them to do all the work to publish that article, to then make it freely available to the world. So that's called an author payment model.
And do authors usually come up with that money through grant funds? Yeah, just make it part of the grant?
Typically coming from a grant. Yeah. And usually a lot of these big grants now have money earmarked in mm-hmm. there for publication fees. But what we're doing, so instead of paying per publication, we're actually flipping the model to a membership model. So we're now actually charging authors per author. They can become a member of PeerJ, and for instance, for $99, that gets them the rights to publish one article with us every year for life. Hmm. It's a lifetime membership model, a single fee, and $99 gets you the ability to publish once a year for life, and it goes up to $299, which gives you that's the all-you-can-eat model. Gives you the unlimited ability to publish as many articles as you want with us every year for life for free.
That seems like a really good deal, Jason.
It's a great deal, yeah.
Jason, you wanted to add something?
Well, it's amazing that within academic publishing, which has been around for a little over 300 years, there have really only been two business models. The one is the subscription model. The second is the author pays per article model, mm-hmm. which was introduced just a few years ago, in fact. And now we think this might be really just a third model within 300 years of how to disseminate research. So, you know, we expect other models to come out as well. So it's very exciting to see open access being a really big part of this, of the change of what's going on in academic publishing.
Yeah. Are you seeing a lot of competitors coming into this space?
So there's a lot of people launching new open access journals mm-hmm. under the author payment model, the per article model.
Right.
I mean, this model was only announced basically 2 weeks ago. We launched on the 12th, 2 weeks ago. So right now, nobody's yet managed to clone our business model. Give them time.
Right.
But certainly we've had a ton of interest, actually, and already some interest from other people who are looking to actually clone this model, perhaps in a different subject area, a different mm-hmm. discipline, which is interesting straight away, the amount of interest that we've got. And people are likening it almost to the original concept of a society. So a society would be, you know, a group of like-minded individuals who would buy into an academic society and would have a publication venue attached to that. And so you could almost see us as forming that kind of a model going forwards, which we think is quite innovative.
Yeah. So the way that you have that you've gotten it started is this. Is this a grand experiment? Are you expecting it to change? That your business model will shift much as we move forward?
So we it is experimental. Of course, nobody else has really tried this before. We've set certain price points that, you know, when we've done the finances, we're pretty confident that works out. You know, obviously once reality hits the rubber, as it were, we may have to adjust and tweak on the fly. But we believe that this business model is sustainable and workable. Down the line, we are going to have, you know, other business models attached to it. For instance, B2B mm-hmm. type of revenue models, perhaps some service models, and so on. But at least initially, this is enough to get the company off the ground and floating.
Yeah.
You know, you showed the screenshot there of the website of if we can sequence the human genome, or at least set a goal to sequence the human genome for $99, then why can't we publish the research about that sequencing for at least $99? Mm-hmm. We actually hope to, over time, drive that cost even further down towards zero, such that we're coming up with other types of revenue streams, because we actually believe it should be as low as possible to be able to publish research.
Yeah, there was a criticism of your work by Scholarly Kitchen, but it was a blog post that was made prior to your actual launch, and so there was a lot of speculation as to what you're actually doing and what your model was going to be. And one of the comments was something to the effect of, "You're going to be publishing papers or reading papers with Google ads in them." I mean, is that the kind of direction that, I mean, are we going to have?
No, and that, you know, that post was misinformed because that was pre-launch when there was basically no information out, but. We're going to be publishing a serious, respectable scientific journal. It's going to look and feel like a real, professionally put together, professionally run, peer-reviewed scholarly journal. So no, it won't be littered with Google AdWords and strange flashing lights and things like that. There may be, for instance, banner advertising across the top of some pages, but that's pretty common in this field. Mm-hmm. But it'll be tastefully done, if done at all.
Tastefully, yes. Irrelevant, most likely.
Yes. So if it does happen, then it'll probably be contextual. So banner adverts related to the content of the article in some way. But that's certainly not the primary business model at all.
Jason?
Well, I agree with Pete there. We're definitely planning to, if we're talking about aesthetics and what to expect from this site, we actually plan to do a bit of innovation there. In fact, if you go to almost pretty much any journal today, their online journal versions, they look like they're dating from the 1990s in terms of web design, web workflows. So, you know, you don't have to do very much to raise the bar within academic publishing online. And so we think that just by doing some nice designs, giving something a little bit better to look at is going to be a welcome surprise to a lot of people that are coming to read the journal and actually interact with it behind the scenes with the peer reviewers and the academic editors.
Are you taking stuff like ebooks into account? iPads, ebooks in the design?
How
people might be consuming the material?
Yeah, so there's a bit of an explosion now of how people consume material and even the raw data. You know, people are trying to get JSON feeds or XML feeds, doing data processing with it. So at the machine level as well. So we're looking both at mobile devices, machine devices, just trying to get the information out there in as many different formats as we can. And for the mobile devices specifically, yes, definitely trying to tailor it so that it looks nice on those devices.
In terms of the pay model, I'm sure you've gotten some critique of the fact that people are paying a membership fee to be able to publish. How do you respond? I mean, what are you doing to make sure that everything is fair and that peer review is not something that is being completely disrupted?
So it's not a vanity model. So they're not paying to publish. They're paying for the service of publication, you know, that's wrapped around the process. But every paper will be peer reviewed by independent academics. We're building a board of academic editors of about 400 people in time for launch.
Oh, wow.
They'll independently peer review each article. They'll have no knowledge of the membership status or the payment status of the author, and decisions will be made completely independently. And then, you know, then it goes on to be published and it goes through production and everything. So the authors can choose to pay at the point of submission, or they can submit for free and only choose to pay the membership fee once they've been accepted for publication, for instance. So it's very much, you know, there's a lot of checks and balances built into the system there.
Yeah, and then once you pay membership, then you're a member.
Yeah, then you get lifetime rights to publish forever for free, which is awesome. I mean, the one thing that we didn't mention about the model is that every author has to be a paying member. So a typical paper might have five authors, so all five of those authors have to have paid a $99 membership fee, for example, or one of the higher tiers. But once they've done that, all subsequent papers are free.
And with the members have to review a paper every year.
So we think that's quite a nice little twist to the model. So there's a real there's a peer review crisis in the world. So there's a lot of papers out there. There's approximately 1.5 million articles published every year, and most of those articles are submitted to a journal. They get peer reviewed and then they get rejected for some spurious reason, such as, you know, it's not impactful, it's not sexy enough, it's too narrow an audience. And so they will then take that paper and go on to another publisher and be peer-reviewed again. So any one paper out of those 1.5 million that end up being published could have been peer-reviewed multiple times by different sets of reviewers and wasting an awful lot of time and effort in the process. So because of the large volume of papers right now, there's a lot of, peer review fatigue in the world. So it's harder and harder to find peer reviewers. People are increasingly, you know, having a problem actually making the time to peer review these papers. So we've got two solutions to that, basically, actually. So the first solution is that we're only going to peer review content for whether or not it's scientifically sound. So we won't be rejecting content based on some spurious, subjective determination of is it impactful, is it sexy, is it a large advance right. in the field. If it's scientifically sound, it will be published somewhere in the literature, so we want to publish it. If it deserves to join the literature, we'll publish it. So from that point of view, it should only be peer-reviewed once. And then the other nice thing that is what you mentioned, one of the requirements of membership is that members should provide some sort of review of one of our publications per year. And so we're being pretty lax about that as well. So it can be a full formal anonymous peer review on an article, but it can just be a comment on a published article or a comment on an article in the preprint server. We just want to encourage the participation of the community in this process of peer review, which is, as you know, is sort of one of the greasing things of the academic publishing world.
It's how science works. It keeps it moving forward. Yeah. It's part of the whole being part of the science community. You need to be a part of this review process. You can't just publish papers, but there's little incentive.
You publish papers, and you know that somebody will be peer reviewing your paper. And then sort of the deal you supposedly strike is that you'll peer review somebody else's paper when you're invited to. And increasingly, I think that deal is starting to break down as people become busier and more overcommitted. And so, like I say, we hope to put some of that sort of incentive back into the system again.
Jason, you wanted to say something?
Just to clarify, that Pete hinted at, we do have the formal peer reviews and then also accepting informal comments to count as a review, the yearly review. But it's fully up to the academic editor to find the peer reviewers. We don't control that process. And so it's still traditional in that respect. We're not going to have random peer reviewers. These will be literally your peers and qualified to do the reviews.
Yeah, good point. And we don't expect the peer reviewers on any given paper to be members of PeerJ. You know, it could literally be anybody worldwide, provided they're the qualified expert to comment on that paper.
Interesting. And I read also that you're looking at trying to make the review process actually open.
Yep.
So that people, instead of being unknowns, unknown quantities, you kind of guess. You go, I think that reviewer was so and so because there aren't that many people in my field. But why not just get rid of that layer of anonymity?
Yeah, and again, this sort of comes with the territory of being an open access publisher. If we can make as much of the process as open as possible, that's in our ethos that we believe that's a good thing. So there's this concept of open peer review, which is normally taken to mean two things: open in the sense that the names of the reviewers are made known to the authors. And then the second aspect of the open peer review is on the finally published paper, all the peer reviews and the versions of the paper and the sort of the peer review audit trail is published alongside the final paper. So we're going to be encouraging both of those. So we're going to encourage but not require authors to provide their names their names to the authors. And we're going to give the authors the option of publishing their peer review audit trail alongside their published paper. And the reason we're not requiring either of those is because this is, it's a difficult concept for some people to understand. There's still a lot of nervousness about requiring these kind of things. So we want to make it optional, prove that it's a valuable thing, and then by the action, as it were, increase the participation.
Right. It'll work and people will want to... want to participate because it'll be then seen as a reputation building.
Exactly. If you provide your name as a peer reviewer, then you'll get credit for that. You'll get status points. You'll get reputation points within the system. But if you remain anonymous, you don't get any of that. For instance, so there are going to be sort of technical incentives built into the system that'll encourage it. And other journals have tried this, the exact same approach of an optional open peer review, and they've had great success. So cool. we expect it to be well adopted.
Yeah. And you also, when you were at PLOS One, you worked a lot in the development of statistics and how everything was measured for its impact, for what was going on. Is there anything that you're taking from what's already been developed other places to measure
absolutely.
What's happening? Because people want to know, even though you are not publishing stuff based on impact... people want to know their impact.
Yeah, and and I think that's been a misconception sometimes with Plos One, is that people think that because Plos One, for instance, which is where I came from, doesn't judge the publication criteria based on impact, that means they're not interested in that question at all. And
right.
And they're simply not interested in asking that question before publication. They don't want two anonymous peer reviewers to make a decision that this paper is either impactful or not, and therefore right. influence the future course of that paper. And so we're, again, taking a very similar angle to that. So our criteria don't ask, you know, how impactful it is in order to make the decision about publication. But once it's published, it's absolutely the case that the people want to know, was this a good paper or a bad paper? Was it impactful or not? Mm-hmm. Was it a great degree of advance or not so great? And so what PLOS pioneered for that problem is article-level metrics. So mm-hmm. for any given article, PLOS, for instance, counts the online usage of the PDF, the HTML, the XML. They provide the scholarly citations as measured by several citation counting databases. They provide the number of tweets, the number of Facebook likes, the number of social bookmarks in various academic bookmarking services. And we plan on providing that full suite of article level metrics as well. I think it's just really important for evaluating content in this day and age.
People do want to see where they rank,
absolutely.
Where they end up.
Yeah.
I mean, life's a game, right?
No, that leaderboard concept is very appealing, even to academics, of course. Yeah.
It is. You don't get away from any game theory anywhere. Jason, with your history in working with data and AP and the Mendeley API, how is the PeerJ platform going to be opened up? We've talked about it being open in mm-hmm. all aspects. Is that how's that going to work for your data?
So we would definitely like to encourage more open science and open data, and so we're trying to explore best how do you present that. You know, there are already some budding sites that allow scientists to do such. You know, one's Figshare. There's the Data Dryad that applies DOIs to data sets so that you can start actually citing data sets themselves. And so it's just a way of figuring out how do we balance sort of the user interface aspect with loads and loads of data. You take a microarray experiment, for example, in genomics that produces a whole lot of data, terabytes of data.
Yeah.
Do you really want all of that available, or what do you do? So we're looking into how do we handle this deluge of data and make it sensible. We're looking into partnering with people who are already doing some good things with this, trying to structure the data, presenting it back out as APIs so that you can then mix up the different data sets, because another major problem within science is you have data coming in at different formats and it's incompatible with each other. So one of the goals is to make that data compatible with each other so you can start teasing out new insights.
Yeah, I think try and get insights as to, once again, how the papers are hitting the public, how they're hitting the scientific community, where they're going. Mm-hmm. In terms of the social community that you're developing, is there anything that you're specifically, there's the reviewer aspects, there's the membership aspect, but is there anything that you're really hoping is going to be like a glue that will really get people to cement into this community? Because you could publish a paper, do your membership, and then you never come back. Right? Mm-hmm. Or are you expecting that?
Well, as long as we're driving the costs down, the whole production costs, then it doesn't matter. We want people to come back to us more and more. And I did drop off for a second there, so I don't know if you touched upon the preprint server also
mm-mm.
Introducing. And maybe I'm cutting into your program here of what you wanted to talk about, but the preprint server is an interesting thing, and you know, our journal we're focusing at the beginning is on the biomedical sciences, so a preprint server is still a little off on the edges in terms of what the community thinks of it. It's very popular now, of course, within the physics community. There is archive.org, that's A-R-I-X-I-V.org. And it kind of acts as a, before the peer review process happens, it's a bit of a filter. It's a chance for physicists to put their stuff up, get some feedback, gain credibility, mm-hmm. set the precedents before they have to go through a potentially lengthy months-long peer review process. So we're hoping then, to get back to your original question, that the preprint server might spur on more engagement with our community and have a really active site once we get it going. And there's a lot of ifs there, of course, and challenges. How do you get that initial engagement going in the workflow?
Yeah, I love the idea of the preprint server. I think that archive.org has become an amazing resource for the physics and mm-hmm. physical sciences community. One of the problems that I run into from a kind of journalistic media side of things is that there are a lot of people who report on things from archive.org as if it's already been yes. peer-reviewed, because it has gotten so much respectability at this point. So is there anything that that you're going to be doing to be communicating various stories, papers that are coming out of your servers?
Well, we'll definitely be doing the standard sort of press releases of mm-hmm. published papers. But I think to speak to your point, I think we'll probably only be doing that on the finally published peer-reviewed version of right. the articles, rather than these preprint versions, which should be seen as working drafts, you know, works mm-hmm. in progress. And they're not necessarily the newsworthy, you know, published article until it's been verified by, you know, some members of the scientific community and then had a seal of authority put in it. So we will be, you know, encouraging press coverage, but I think only on the finally published peer-reviewed articles there.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that it's interesting to talk about the preprint server, because it's been wildly successful in the physics and hard scientists world. Some huge percentage, like 80% of all papers in some fields of physics now appear in the archive before going on to be published in a real journal. But the biosciences have really, it's not taken off at all. There's been a couple of experiments that have actually been closed down, even, you know, they've failed badly. And it seems it's because, you know, the bioscientists, the biologists, the medical people, just they don't have a preprint server mentality in their culture. They don't have this mentality of sharing output before it's ready for prime time, as it mm-hmm. were. And I think part of the reason there is, you know, there's some real money associated with what they're doing. They're working on patents. They're working on, you know, big sort of biotech pharma mm-hmm. type of work. And why should they tell their competitive, you know, groups what they're doing and what they're up mm-hmm. to? So we think, again, the innovation that we've managed to put in place here to encourage use of the preprint server is actually we're going to give the authors a full suite of privacy controls for their papers. So they can submit papers into the preprint server, and they can restrict access to a certain amount of content. So they can restrict access, for instance, just to the title plus the authors, basically, or the title plus the abstract, mm-hmm. or the full content. So if they want, they can simply say, we've got a paper, it's under preparation, here's the title. That's it. And then they can, additionally, they can restrict access to an audience group as well. So they can share it only with their friends via a private link, with all other members of the PeerJ community, or with the entire world. So we think that by giving, as it were, the control back to the authors, just like with the open peer review concept that we've got, if we give the control back to the users of how much they share and how widely they share it, then we hope that they'll actually adopt it.
And one hopes then that the community itself will start to incentivize each other. If, you know, some people are naturally going to be fully open from the start, and hopefully the peers who are not so open at the beginning will start to see that and start to see the engagement that their open peers are getting on those preprint articles. And potentially, you know, it'll become increasingly open amongst the entire community. But Pete's right, we definitely have to get people warmed up to this and give them as much privacy as they'd like.
Yeah, although, you know, just to reiterate, that only applies to the preprint server. So the journal is a fully open access journal. They've got no choice.
So once it goes from the preprint, they've done some edits, they've gotten their feedback from the community, and they submit to be published, then that's just going to go out and be open to the public.
Yeah, then it goes into the peer review process, it gets accepted, and it's just publicly available. And then there's also an audit trail. You know, there's still the preprint version up on the preprint server. So as a user, you can go back and see the various revisions that went towards the final published version, and hopefully see the peer review history as well.
Which, once again, makes the whole scientific process just opens it up to anybody, so it becomes transparent and people can understand the thought processes.
Yeah, which, you know, has only got to benefit the process. I mean, the current situation of a very secretive process, very confidential, very anonymous.
Doing science.
Yes, it's
I'm
just
not going to tell you what I'm doing.
It's just not conducive to the to a modern paced scientific discovery process. This is not the best way to do it, and so we believe we've got a good solution that is, if not the best, but at least dramatically better way to do these things.
Yeah, so in terms of response from the publishing community, you launched on the 12th of this month, so
2 weeks ago.
And you've gotten a lot of responses, but how the publishing community, is there a response from people, groups like Elsevier?
Not so much. I mean, so there's been, we got a huge amount of very positive coverage. We had articles in Nature, Science, the Chronicle of Higher Education, the Times Higher Education, so Ars Technica, Pando Daily. So we got amazing coverage from the media, as it were. There isn't really, you know, an official mouthpiece of the publishing industry that could have responded, although the Scholarly Kitchen blog that you mentioned earlier did write two pieces on us just 2 days after we launched, which was interesting. It was both written by the same person, and in the one post, he was bemoaning the fact that Silicon Valley VCs were moving in on the publishing world and trying to make a quick buck and get out fast. And then the second post was very much along the lines of, and anyway, it'll never work. The finances don't work out and it's unsustainable. So it's like, well what is it? Are we going to make a lot of money? Are we going to go bankrupt overnight? And so it was a somewhat confused response, I think, from the publishing industry. But I think that a lot of people are watching this. What we have heard is it's made a lot of ripples. We have had some private contacts from my contacts in the publishing world who are very interested, I think, in how successful or not this model might be. Yeah.
And in terms of what you're doing, the Journal of Visualized Experiments, that didn't really take off. They had problems with the videos. The video is expensive.
Yeah.
There's a lot, you need a lot of space
to
do video, and you need and so their model did not work.
So what we think, I think, is a nice sort of angle we've got is that we're taking the best of both worlds. So so in my mind, we're taking the best of the traditional scholarly journal publishing world and the processes that have evolved, the peer review rigor, the ethical standards, the standards of publication, the sort of best aspects of that with the best aspects of sort of modern internet era publishing technology, which is where Jason brings in a lot of knowledge from that point of view. So I think, for instance, we will host some videos, but really we're still talking about the publication of papers, sort of 10 page text heavy papers, because that's what people like to consume. I mean, academics like to write and like to read scholarly articles, papers. They don't necessarily sit on YouTube and watch, an experiment being performed on YouTube. They actually prefer to have a version of record written down that they can refer to. And so we're going with the needs of the community. So that's what they do today. What they do tomorrow, we don't know, but we hope to, evolve with them if they want something else from the service.
Yeah, and so in terms of getting out to the public and the public image that you're putting out there, even though you are a disruptive platform, you are a reputable, reliable, scientific, scholarly publishing outlet.
Definitely, yeah, and that speaks to what Jason was saying earlier. We both of us have a pedigree in the industry that we know what we're doing. We know how to publish a professionally run journal. We've already set up archiving agreements. We've already got, we're registered with the ISSN agency. We've got DOIs assigned. So we know what we're doing, and we're going to do it to the best possible practices in both, as it were, the scholarly publishing world and also the internet publishing world. And so I think that will make people comfortable, I think, with what we're providing.
Are people finding, Jason, that are so far, are people comfortable with what you're putting forward? The image, the fact that you, I mean, you're being called a startup with Silicon Valley VC money, mm-hmm. but I mean, that's not really at your heart. I mean, you're a startup, but still, you're a publishing company for science.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think people recognize that there definitely need to be experiments within academic publishing and with open access. And so most people are extremely either supportive or curious and want us to succeed. And of course, we knew that there would be some doubts as well. Because this is a very radical change from what's been out there. So it's not very surprising that, that there would be some skepticism as well. But it's absolutely amazing. So we don't even open for submissions for another 3 months. People can come to the site and sign up now and buy a membership now. And so what's amazing is to see how many people are signing up and actually paying for a membership despite the fact that we don't even open up for submissions for about 3 months. So I think that's kind of a signal that people are very interested in this type of a model.
Yeah, and it's definitely about time. I mean, what was it, 25,000 signatures on a 27,000 signatures on a petition to the White House to try and get open access pushed through Congress, and additionally a massive number of scientists boycotting Elsevier journals, not publishing in those journals,
mm-hmm. because 12,000 at this point,
it's significant.
It's been a very interesting sort of last 6 months, I think, in this world.
There's,
like I say, there's been those two developments. There's been UCSF has passed an open access mandate in the last month. There's just been a sort of an explosion of interest, you mm-hmm. know, activism, and development. So, you know, the UK government has just committed to making everything open access, and they've brought in Jimmy Wales to run their open access initiative for the UK government, which is incredible. Yes.
And one thing that really hasn't been touched upon quite yet by people, they haven't realized it yet, is despite the fact that we are a for-profit with investors behind mm-hmm. us, if we're successful and if we increase competition to drive open access costs down, governments in the UK, the US, worldwide are going to end up saving literally billions of dollars a year. So if you just took PeerJay's model right now, the academic publishing market's worth about $10 billion annually. If everyone converted to something like $99, governments would be saving about 75% of their current costs on having to publish. And that would be funneled back into research grants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or to the libraries for whatever reason. So despite the fact that we're a for-profit, we're actually a for-profit that is quite a bit lower than most nonprofits and, of course, other paywall publishers.
Yeah, nonprofit doesn't necessarily mean that there's no money being made.
Exactly. Nor do we have CEOs making millions of dollars a year as a nonprofit either.
Says the CEO himself.
No. I wish I had more money. We're a true startup.
You're a true startup, exactly.
Yeah.
On a shoestring.
I eat top ramen
sitting there in his
every
T-shirt.
Night.
Yes.
Just as long as you aren't feeding your baby top ramen.
This is the Food Camp T-shirt. Actually,
yeah.
I don't know if you can see that from a lot of technologists get together every year from Tim O'Reilly's friends of O'Reilly. Yeah.
Nice. So, where are you all? It's been 3 years since the last time we talked. Where mm-hmm. do you expect to be in 3 years?
So, I think a more interesting time frame might be 5 years, actually. So if we were to look out 5 years,
everyone has a five-year plan.
And it's not so much that we have a five-year plan. It's just that I foresee significant disruption in the industry in the five-year time frame, personally. So Plos One, the journal that I just came from, is this year probably going to publish about 3% of the world's literature in a single journal out of 25,000 journals. And Plus One is almost doubling in size every year right now.
Wow.
And there's been a lot of competitors to Plus One launched in the last year or 18 months. And to be honest, that's what we are. We're a journal that looks and feels a lot like Plus One, and we expect and hope to grow in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you project that trend forward a few years, and it's going to take a little bit more than three, but if you look at the five-year time frame, I'm on record actually in other places of predicting that by that point the industry has entirely flipped to an open access model. Well over 50% of the content in the world is being published in an open access license, and at that point it's an accelerating movement. So I think if you look out 5 years' time, the prediction is that well over 50% of content is being published in an open access venue. That perhaps a lot of it looks and feels like a Plus One journal. Very large journals publishing a lot of content that's been vetted for scientific validity. But so that's I think where we're aiming.
And we're going to have, because of open access and open data becoming more and more popular, with that 50% being open access, if Pete's right about that, we're going to have an explosion of research discoveries, because now we're going to be able to not just read the literature wherever you are, but also machines getting together and being able to process that, the whole data-intensive research that is sorely needed. You can't do that with literature or data that's behind a paywall. You can't process all that information. So there's going to be some huge discoveries that we start making in these next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. So at the moment, perhaps only about 10% of the world's literature is being published open access by a number of open access publishers. And so really, they haven't managed to prove, as it were, the benefit of publishing open access yet. There isn't a large enough corpus of content for them to run those machines over and come up with new discoveries and new trends that they can spot in the data. But as Jason just said, in the five-year time frame, I think we're going to start to see just an explosion of new discoveries based on the fact that you can actually get at this content better.
That's going to be really incredible. Yeah. That'll be just the explosion. I'm waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be awesome. I'm waiting. Like the super volcano. Super volcano of scientific publishing.
Viewing results all over the landscape.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think at the beginning... At the top of the show, when I was introducing you, Jason, your bio says that you believe that open access is really going to be able to solve this century's biggest challenges. And with the ability to be able to look at all the data, with the ability to be able to get people all over the world access to stuff that they wouldn't originally be able to access, we may very well have discoveries being made that would not be made otherwise. We may have
Definitely. We may have
people being helped in different parts of the country, the world, that are not being helped currently because of paywalls.
Yeah, it's going to add a lot of transparency, not only within the research world, but I think in other fields too. If you're thinking about politics, this is going to spur transparency there as well. If we get things... more of the peer research being known, spread across the world, people are going to be able to take that and do an action with it and change their communities or their lives as well. So, I don't want to get too naive or pie in the sky with this, but we're gonna see some amazing changes, I hope.
But yeah, and I think that is the inspirational message here. It can be very dry and sort of a bit technical talking about copyright licenses and open access publishing and peer review and it's what we're knee deep in because we run that kind of a process, but the inspirational sort of point of doing this is exactly what Jason just said. We're going to spur new discoveries, we're going to improve society, we're going to accelerate the pace of science, we're going to make those dollars go further. It's these are all fantastic outcomes of what we're doing, we think.
I think it's fantastic. Yeah. Good luck to you guys. I am behind this 100%. I think science and the discoveries that come through science needs to all be open. open, spur more science. We are at the end of the hour, unfortunately.
Oh, that went fast.
I know.
Spur more science hour, too.
Spur more science hour.
This cannot be the last show.
This is the last show. This is the very last science hour, unfortunately. But, you know, that doesn't mean this is the last that people are going to see of me. I've got more science to talk about, more people to interview. I've got ideas, and I have things I'd like to do. So, you know, this is all an opportunity. It's all a grand experiment, and everything is an opportunity. And, you know, in terms of the big inspiration as to why you do something, I mean, I want to inspire people to make discoveries, to get out there and ask about the world. And
absolutely.
You know, yeah. I think it's important. So anyway, thank you, Peter Binfield, Jason Hoyt from PeerJ.com. Thank you very much for joining me on the show today and talking about open access and what you are doing to disrupt the scientific publishing community. And I know that 3 years is about what it's going to take to find out what your impact factor is through the way that they measure impact factor for journals. So we'll be checking back in.
Yes. Schedule us in 3 years. Yeah.
Whatever I'm doing, I'll schedule you in 3 years.
Every 3 years, we're going to come back and report. Yeah.
I think it's good. 3-year reunion, exactly. You can go to peerj.com. That's P-E-E-R-J, the letter J.com, for more information. You can also follow them on Twitter. It's at thepeerj.com over on Twitter. There it is up on the screen right now. I am Dr. Kiki, and this has been the very last ever episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm sad to go, but like I said, I'm sure this is an opportunity to do something amazing, and I will take advantage of that. So until that amazing thing happens, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki. On Facebook, I have a Facebook page, Dr. Kiki. Additionally, you can find me on Google+. Kiki Sanford is the name I am under there. And you can find me online. My website is drkiki.tv. And you can email me at drkiki@drkiki.tv. You can leave me a voicemail at 650-741-5454. That's really 650-741-KIKI. It is. And you can find past episodes of this show at twit.tv/KIKI, even though at episode 149, the series is coming to an end. It will live on because of the wonders of the internet and archiving. So yes, all the shows will remain on the Twit network for I don't know how long, at least till tomorrow. I don't know, for a little while. So you can watch all those past episodes. And I'd love to know what some of your favorite clips from past episodes. What episodes did you like the best? What clips, little bits and pieces? Put things on YouTube. Share them with me. Let me know what you like. I like to know what you like. It's what I like. And let's see, if you want more sciencey goodness, you can also go to twiss.org. That's This Week in Science. Twiss, it's my other program. It will continue. It will no longer be on the Twit Network, but Twiss will continue. And so every Thursday evening, every week, I don't know exactly how it's going to work, but every week we'll be doing an episode. You'll be able to download the audio podcast the same way you always have. That's not going to change. You can go to the website, twiss.org. We will be there. You can find more information there if you want to find out about future live broadcasts. Thanks for tuning in to my Science Hour. All I've ever really asked for is 1 hour a week. And I do hope that this hour made your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week.
When people look at it, it looks crazy. That's a very natural thing. Sometimes when we look at it, it looks crazy. It is the result of reasoned engineering thought, but it still looks crazy. From the top of the atmosphere down to the surface, it takes 7 minutes. It takes 14 minutes or so for the signal from the spacecraft to make it to Earth. That's how far Mars is away from us. So when we first get word that we've touched the top of the atmosphere, the vehicle has been alive or dead on the surface for at least 7 minutes.
Entry, descent, and landing, also known as EDL, is referred to as the 7 minutes of terror, because we've got literally 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the surface of Mars, going from 13,000 miles an hour to zero, in perfect sequence, perfect choreography, perfect timing, and the computer has to do it all by itself with no help from the ground. If any one thing doesn't work just right, it's game over.
We slam into the atmosphere and develop so much aerodynamic drag, our heat shield, it heats up and it glows like the surface of the sun. 1600 degrees.
During entry, the vehicle is not only slowing down violently through the atmosphere, but also we are guiding it like an airplane to be able to land in a very narrow constrained space. This is one of the biggest challenges that we are facing, and one that we have never attempted on Mars.
Mars is actually really hard to slow down, because it has just enough atmosphere that you have to deal with it. Otherwise, it will destroy your spacecraft. On the other hand, it doesn't have enough atmosphere to finish the job. We're still going about 1,000 miles an hour. So at that point, we use a parachute.
The parachute is the largest and strongest supersonic parachute that we've ever built to date. It has to be able to withstand 65,000 pounds of force, even though the parachute itself only weighs about 100 pounds.
When it opens up that fast, it's a neck snapping 9 G's.
At that point, we have to get that heat shield off. It's like a big lens cap blocking our view of the ground to the radar. The radar has to take just the right altitude and velocity measurements at just the right time, or the rest of the landing sequence won't work.
This big, huge parachute that we've got, it'll only slow us down to about 200 miles an hour. And that's not slow enough to land. So we have no choice, but we've got to cut it off and then come down in rockets. Once we turn those rocket motors on, if we don't do something, we're just going to smack right back into the parachute. So the first thing we do is make this really radical divert maneuver. We fly off to the side.
Diverting away from the parachute, killing our horizontal velocity and our vertical velocity, getting the rover moving straight up and down so it can look at the surface with its radar and see where we're going to land. And we head straight down to the bottom of a crater right beside a 6 kilometer high mountain.
We can't get those rocket engines too close to the ground, because if we were to descend propulsively with our engines all the way to the ground, we would essentially create this massive dust cloud. That dust cloud could then go and land on the rover. It could damage mechanisms and it could damage instruments. So the way we solve that problem is by using the Skycran maneuver.
20 meters above the surface, we have to lower the rover below us on a tether that's 21 feet long, and then gently deposit it on its wheels on the surface.
As the rover touches down and is now on the ground, the descent stage is in a collision course with the rover. We must cut the bridle immediately and fly the descent stage to a safe distance from the rover.